This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. The filibuster. We go immediately to the Constitution of the United States. This is the 18th century speaking to the 20th and 21st century now. It ensures a Republican form of government in all the states of the Union so conceived. It's very specific about the word Republican. It capitalizes it. Richard, a very good evening to you. Thank you very much. The Constitution not only has a Republican form of government in the nation's capital, and at the time it was barely 13 states, but also insists that it also be applied to all the states. So we need to recapture that word from the 18th century. What does Republican, and they use a capital R, but that's uniform copy editing in the 18th century to capitalize almost every noun. What does a Republican form of government entail in the minds of the founders? Good evening to you.
Yeah, well, the term was one of art. And if you go back to the classical theory, there were opposition. You had a monarchy or a tyranny. You had an aristocracy or an oligopoly, or you could have a democratic or republican form of government. One in these paths was bad. The other was good. Democracy was always thought to be a bad thing under this model because it allowed simple majorities to take control of everything and thereby to plunder the wealth of those people who were left in the minority. They didn't have at that time a Bill of Rights built into the situation that would prevent this. So they hoped that a more elaborate set of procedures would, in effect, slow down the bad legislation more than it would slow down the good legislation. So, for example, the Senate, when this thing was passed, was not chosen by the public at large. That was a progressive reform of Woodrow Wilson. It was chosen by the state delegates, and they were designed to try to keep everything under control. Now, if you're running in that kind of a mind and you get to the Senate, the question is, how do they want to organize their internal rules? And that was given to them quite expressly under Article 5 of the first Article 1, Section 5 of the first clause. And the filibuster became kind of natural in that. It would slow things down inside the Senate and improve deliberation. And for the most part, it kind of worked. But there is nothing which says how large that majority ought to be. When we passed the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it was a two-thirds vote that you needed to get cloture. And they passed that bill by a 71 vote to 29 vote situation or outcome. All right, so you're doing that. Then they had to lower it because it was too high, and they put it down to 60. Well, if you're doing it for substantive legislation, it works. But then it turns out there are exceptions to that, given the many things that the Senate does. One of the things it does is it confirms nominations for judgeships. And if you have a Senate which is closely divided, say 55-45, and you have a filibuster, and you could filibuster judges, you could keep the courts empty. And while you might not have any real need to press new legislation, you certainly have need to fill up key political appointments for the president, and you have to appoint people on the bench. And so first Harry Reid, when frustrated, took it out for lower court justices. And then when Mitch McConnell became president, he did the same thing with respect to senior appointments into the Supreme Court. And the theory was, we've got to get this done. And I approve of that particular situation, even though I would want to keep, as they did, the filibuster for ordinary legislation. Now, a continuing resolution is not ordinary legislation. There was nobody who filibustered the continuing resolution because they were against it. They all were in favor of it. Democrats are always big spenders. The point is, it was used here as a tool in order to extract concessions from the majority, which you could have not done if you'd gone through the standard legitimate legislative procedures, both houses and so forth. Well, when you start doing that, there's a kind of a whiff of corruption that's in the opposition. And the question is, what are they asking for? It could be anything. In this case, it was like $350 billion over a 10-year window to reform some of the medical provisions and services. And what made it particularly egregious is these things were passed on the explicit assumption that these were temporary measures. And now all of a sudden, the Democrats in a minority position want to make them into majority. If they could get it as a majority vote, I'm going to say, well, that's just fine. It could be attacked like any other legislation on constitutional grounds. And most of those attacks will fail. But in this case, it just led to horrendous dislocation because the guys who put the filibuster in place did not really want to shut down the government. They didn't want to slow down the airlines. They didn't want to make paid governments going without wages for their key employees. That was not their program. They were basically holding individuals hostages in order to achieve what they regarded as a legitimate political goal by what I regard as an illegitimate manner. And so the proposal that I made is really quite simple, is you don't allow filibusters to deal with continuing resolutions, period. And that way this whole thing ends. And what happens is you do it by Senate rule. My view is they could have adjourned the Senate, reconvened it, and actually at that time passed an anti-filibuster rule with respect to continuing resolution and solved the thing in one day. I wish I had thought of it earlier because I think it's actually the right situation. And it shows you that in many cases, when you're dealing with various kinds of complicated institutions, you don't want to manipulate in kinds of corrupt and funny fashions within the system. What you want to do is to change the rule. And one of the fundamental rules of property law, which carries over to political science, is you never want to give anybody a veto right over something which prevents productive uses of assets.
Richard, so, I'd like to introduce another thought about the filibuster.
Sure.
That it insists upon a mitigation of partisanship, especially extreme partisanship. The parties in the House and the Senate these days are voting in blocks.
Yes.
And the filibuster insists that if there's legislation or conduct to be vouchsafed, it needs to have some of the opposing forces recognize that it is in the interest of the United States. And here's why. My thinking is idealistic, I understand. I admit that I'm not a practicing politician, but still, what we have today is extreme partisanship at all levels, even down to the dinnerware that you choose for an evening. It's that bad. And any attempt to mitigate that partisanship is welcome. For example, the way that this present quandary was solved was 8 senators from the Democratic Party voted with the Republicans. That means they took the nuclear weapon out of the missile, so that there's a lot of cross-talking right now, but not anger or fear or people representing, you know, one team versus the other team. Isn't that I think that's a positive, Richard.
Well, let me put it this way. I think it's a positive, but also a negative. They did this only after 40-odd days. And what I'm saying is you don't want to have even one day of a holdout where you have to have these massive negotiations. If you were having a holdout to deliberate the merits of the extension of the debt limits, I would understand that. But that's not what this was about. Everybody agreed that it had to go through. And so they were using it for collateral purposes, which bear no relationship to the original design. And I'm in favor of the filibuster for ordinary legislation for exactly the same reason you said. If you don't want things to go forward, particularly in a hyperpartisan ear in which you only have your own party and nobody from the other side, it's just much too dangerous to have a bill that goes exactly in that fashion. And we're seeing this at the state level right now as we watch the various states move like California to change the rules for reapportionment in order to increase Democratic majorities. That's also the kind of insane situation. So you do need to have constant checks on all these political events. And what this does, in effect, is it means two things. One is that courts have to be more active than they might otherwise be, and they're not very good at that. And the other thing is we have to rethink all the rules that we've put in place for a very long period of time, see which of them survive and which of them do not. And I think the proposal that I made has no serious downside. And what it does is it says when you now want to pass legislation in the correct fashion, you do have the filibuster, and that means you have to make compromises to get the other side to go along with you, which I think is fine. But nobody here wanted to make any compromise on the national debt. And as I quoted in a little article I wrote at the Civitas Institute, one of the guys who was most insistent about this when he was active was Paul Krugman, who always used to rail about this for exactly this kind of reason. So if you're going to get a bipartisan correspondent of Epstein and Krugman, I mean, how could you ever be worse than that? So I don't think that we want to go back to the old rule. And I think that it should now be made a permanent part of the corpus that carries over from one legislation to another. If we understand why we need an exception for judges, and high political appointees, we have to understand that we need another exception. And the filibuster, as controversial as it is, probably works best only when it's dealing with substantive legislation, including appropriations. And that's not what's happening in this particular case. So this was an American tragedy. And we don't even know who won or lost. Because the Democrats were going around and saying, well, why did those guys buckle? And what they want to do is they want to take the head, it's going to go anyhow, of Chuck Schumer, because he couldn't keep those dissidents in line. And I think what you think is that dissidents are the heroes. They're not the fools. At least they recognize that they were cutting off their nose to spite their face and that they had to open this government up. I mean, I can tell you all the people I know who waited 4 hours in the airport to find that their flight was canceled. They really didn't have views on anything having to do with the continuing resolution. Except we've always done this. Let's do it again. And the hardship was simply too great, just as the hardship from tariffs turns out to be too great. And Americans, what they will do is they will compromise when they have to, and their back is to the wall. I just want this compromise to take place much earlier and much more decisively so we don't have to go through the ordeal.
The BBC is calling, Richard. Professor Richard Epstein of the Civitas Institute at the University of Texas at Austin. He teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago. The difference between the systems, the court systems of the Mother Britain and the United States are profound when it comes to defamation. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.